Excuse me, Lisa, but I couldn't help but overhear your nerdly predicament. Maybe I can be of assistance with the dancing, twisting, kung fu fighting, diddly-diddly-dee-doo.
Welcome, everyone. It's time for the Student Union. This is your host, Pastor Marcus Zill, coming to you live, well, almost live, from the beautiful campus of LCMSU. Where is LCMSU?
It's everywhere.
Good to have you with us, everyone. Welcome to the Student Union. It is great to be back with you. As we get started here with today's interview, just one quick note. Pastor Scott Stigemeyer, who is our guest, is fantastic on a very timely topic. Pastor Stigemeyer is the Assistant Professor of Bioethics and Theology at Concordia University in Irvine. Welcome to the program, Scott.
Hey, Marcus. It's great to be here.
Hey, it's great to have you here. Pastor Stigemeyer and I went to seminary together at Fort Wayne. I think you graduated a year in front of me. As I recall, we like to point out our alma maters. Your alma mater is Concordia Ann Arbor. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, it is. Where'd you go?
I went to Pacific Lutheran University, an ELCA school in Tacoma, Washington. Went out there on a basketball scholarship and then quit the team halfway through the year. But anyways, love the West Coast, as I'm sure you're enjoying the beautiful weather you have out there in Orange County, California.
Yeah, you know, that's really one of the huge things I have to say. You move out here from the Midwest is how many sunny days there are. I'm used to growing up this having so many overcast days. And so, yeah, I'm loving the sun.
You wake up and it's like, oh, the sun is up just like every other day.
Right. It's another beautiful day. That's great.
And Pastor Stigemeyer has a couple of podcasts, Culture and Christianity and The Crux of the Matter. And I will send a Facebook post out on facebook.com/LCMSU after the program here, and I'll kind of push those a little bit. But, Scott, the reason why we wanted to have you on today, there's been a lot of talk going on in our church circles in the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod about this gender dysphoria. I think it used to be called gender identity disorder. And while I want to caution everybody that's listening out there, we don't want to get into the specifics of any specific situation. I mean, people are familiar with the Bruce Caitlyn Jenner situation, but there are some things kind of going around within some of our own circles, and it seems to me that while this is kind of a new topic for many of us, that if it's kind of hitting close to home for some of us that are a bit older, I'm sure it's hitting real close to home for a lot of our students that are on college campuses where LGBTQ issues prop up religiously.
Absolutely.
Can you help us out? I know that you have a unique perspective. You not only have served many years as a pastor, but are now serving as a professor at Concordia University Irvine and studying, and you've got a master's degree in bioethics.
That's correct.
And what is this gender dysphoria thing? Because the first thing we got to understand is, what is it?
I would say first we have to understand how the terms gender and the term sex are used differently.
Okay.
For most of our history and many times now still, people use those terms interchangeably, right, as synonyms, gender, sex. But in the 1970s, a doctor at Johns Hopkins University by the name of John Money, he claims that he coined the distinction between sex and gender. So sex refers to your biology, your anatomy, that you have certain genitalia and secondary sex characteristics. But gender, however, refers to who you are socially, how you present yourself, whether you think of yourself as male or female. It has more to do with identity that is not attached or not shackled to your anatomy. Okay. So what happens with gender dysphoria? The word dysphoria is, think of it as the opposite of euphoria. Euphoria is when you feel good, you know, you meaning good. And so dysphoria is a sense of distress. It's suffering. And so when people are suffering because their felt gender in their mind, there's this sense that they are male or female. If I asked you if you were a man or a woman, you wouldn't have to question. Most people never think about their gender identity very much. It's just who they are. But for some people, there are those who say, you know what, in my mind, I think I'm male. I think I'm female. But my anatomy is the opposite. And it's hard for someone who maybe doesn't experience this to understand. But this discongruity, this incongruity, causes a great deal of psychological pain. And it can cause a lot of social pain, too. So think of it as if you were going around trying to, you know, Marcus, you and I are both men. We're going around to say we wanted to dress like men. We wanted to talk like men. We wanted people to speak of us as men. But everyone you know refers to you as a woman. That would be socially off-putting to you and me. And so that's what they're experiencing. You know, I'm not at this level. We're not talking about, you know, cause or, you know, morality. We're just trying to at first. Let's just try to understand what they're experiencing. And that's the best explanation I think I can give.
Is it something that happens typically early on in life? Is it something that's developed later?
There's both. There are cases where it's a later onset, but there's plenty of cases where it exists in childhood. I don't know the statistics, but I know that there are many cases. The psychological profession has a diagnostic manual. It's called the DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, mm-hmm. and version 5 is out. And they have two separate sections in there on gender dysphoria for adults and gender dysphoria for children and teens. And it can be diagnosed or has been diagnosed with very young children, 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old. The thing is, most kids who experience gender dysphoria outgrow it. It's about 3 out of 4, about 3 out of 4 that have some kind of gender dysphoria as a child, either resolve that or they sublimate it somehow as an adult. But there are those for whom that feeling of being out of sorts never goes away and only gets worse the older they get.
Is this the type of thing that, I mean, I remember growing up, and times have sure changed from when we were kids when, you know, you told Susie not to play with, you know, G.I. Joe dolls, and you told, you know, the girls, to, you know, you don't want to be a tomboy, you don't want to be that kind of thing. I mean, how much does that play into it? Is it, is this a mental thing? Is it a physical thing? Help us understand. I mean, trying to wrap my head around, is this learned behavior? Learned reflection and confusion, or is it, you know, because you do have people that are born with, you know, kind of hermaphrodite kind of situations. If you could touch base on that a little bit too.
Sure. Well, first, the hermaphrodite situation. A true hermaphrodite is, now we would use the word intersex. And an intersex person is someone, they're not a traditional gender dysphoric patient. A person who's intersex actually has ambiguous anatomy. And there's a whole bunch of different disorders or a whole bunch of different syndromes that can fall under that heading. But someone might have testes and ovaries, or they may have testes, but their body cannot process the testosterone, so they develop breasts, and they, you know, they develop like a female. You know, so I mean, that's something else. I mean, that's a very serious issue. Now, it's rare. But those things do occur. And usually with those, at least the standard of care up to now has been to try to do surgery as young as possible. But that's changing. So, for instance, let's say your child is born and the genitalia are not formed properly. The doctors would maybe suggest, look, it looks like the beginning of a penis was here, but it's not really formed well. Maybe let's just remove it and make your child a girl. You raise her as a girl. What they do now is say, don't do that. But the standard of care now says, if it's ambiguous, you simply let the child grow and let them. I mean, it's hard to imagine, because what's the first question someone asks when you have a baby?
Is it a boy or is it a girl?
Right. And how are you going to now say, you know what, we don't know.
What's the name?
Yeah, right. How do you name your child and how do you identify them as a male or female? Well, a lot of physicians are saying now, instead of a doctor sort of paternalistically saying, because if I'm a surgeon, I'm a pediatric surgeon and I have to make that decision on an infant, well, I'm going to choose female because it's a whole lot easier to remove organs than to build organs. And there have been so many people for whom that has occurred that when they grow up, they're like, you know what? Why do I feel like I'm a man? And so, well, you did have the beginnings, or you did have ambiguous genitalia. But that's intersex. That's a little different. When we talk about gender dysphoria, usually, and transsexuals or transgenderism, usually what we're talking about is someone whose anatomy is not flawed, whose anatomy is normal, if you will.
So they look like a man, talk like a yep. man, act like a man,
right.
feel like a woman.
They may be very masculine, and in their mind they feel like that's a charade. They may feel like they're not really being themselves. They might be effeminate. You know, there is a spectrum, right? I mean, you can be a man, your sex be male, but you might be very masculine and like to hunt and kill and play sports and work on cars, or you might be kind of artistic and like to dance and, you know, and but that doesn't mean you're gay, but we do tend to say there, you know, you can be a little more feminine or effeminate or a little more masculine. And a gender dysphoric patient, I mean, Bruce Jenner was definitely a masculine male. This is an
Olympic. You don't get much more masculine than being an Olympic athlete.
Right. He was definitely and a handsome one. So, I mean, he certainly was and he's a father. I mean, he experienced life as a male. Now, I'm not an expert and I haven't obviously talked to him, but I know that, you know, this was something that he's just been struggling with for a very long time. And it's hard for us who don't have that struggle to really relate. So that's intersex. And what was I think you started to ask me. Oh, yeah. Is it physical or is it mental?
Well, it seems to me that is, obviously if you have an intersex situation, I mean, it's a completely different ballgame. And I'm assuming putting your theological hat on, I mean, all these things, you know, it's not like 50 years ago we didn't have, I mean, it seems like this is all just being front and center right now, but ever since the fall, we've...
Absolutely.
And so how do you theologically put this in perspective? I mean, what is it the cause of this in terms of, how would you explain to someone that is struggling with this of how they are in this condition in the first place?
Well, this is, from my understanding, and I'm not a psychotherapist, but from the reading that I have done, Marcus, I don't believe that someone just wakes up someday and chooses to have gender dysphoria. You know, I'm just deciding to be so miserable that I'm either going to be suicidal or I'm going to need to have irreversible surgeries done on my private parts. I don't think people choose that. I think that it is a result of the fall. Perhaps it's mental illness. Some authors have compared gender dysphoria to another condition that we're a little more familiar with and comfortable with, and that's anorexia nervosa. Okay. If someone is an eating disorder, an anorexic has a sense that they are fat. They just have this compulsion, this feeling, this insistence. It's not that they look in a mirror and literally their eyeballs see a fat person. They just can't get over the mindset that they're overweight, and so they harm their bodies in order to fit an idealized vision of what their body ought to be. And I think that something similar might be going on with gender dysphoria. They have this conception in their brain, this schema in their head of what they are, but that's not the same thing that everyone else is telling them that they are. And it's just very, very difficult for them. I think it's a mental disorder. There's probably some various hormonal causes. A lot of intrauterine things go on when you're developing as a fetus, and so there probably is something with the brain that has caused this. I don't think it's just somebody learned this behavior, although. You know, to get back to what you were saying a minute ago, Marcus, there are definitely kids who are just experimenting. You know, if a kid just wants to play dress up and is just experimenting, I wouldn't get freaked out and say, oh, no, this is gender dysphoria. Gender dysphoria, in order to, you know, to be diagnosed, they have to say, they have to be insistent that they belong to the other gender and that they want to get rid of their body parts that mark them as one gender or the other. And they, you know, it's an insistence, and it's, and it must go over a length of time. It must persist. It's not just one day, you know, the 2-year-old child wore mommy's wig or something, or played with Barbies not knowing any better. We're talking about someone that is, as they start to grow up, they just always, for whatever reason, insist that they're that they are the other sex.
Now, that's very helpful. Is it important to also not, because I think I would make this mistake myself, to not assume, like you started out saying, the difference between gender and sex? Someone who's got gender dysphoria, they aren't necessarily sexually attracted to someone of the opposite sex or the same. I mean, how does that play into it?
No, you're right.
I mean, if it's, say a man feels like he's a woman, it doesn't mean that he's, and he wants to become a woman. Does he view himself as in a homosexual or lesbian type thing, or is it not necessarily so?
Well, it could go either way. There are different types. This is such a complex subject. There are different types of gender dysphoria and different types of transsexuals. There are some. There's one type where it's a biological male who is attracted to males. Okay, this is someone who is, we would call, a homosexual, and they are unlikely to marry a woman and have biological children, and they recall having childhood femininity characteristics, and they transition. If they're going to transition, they usually transition younger. That's one type of transsexual. Another type of transsexual is a man who is not attracted to other men, is attracted to women, and these typically transition at an older age. They're more likely to have married a woman and fathered biologic children, and don't recall a lot of childhood femininity. So but then it's complicated. Let's say a man who loves women, we would say he's heterosexual, but now he wants to become a woman. Now, is he a lesbian? Well, I guess so. I guess so.
Well, we have about 5 minutes here, and I want to, this is all very, very helpful. I can see that we could have like 20 shows on this. But what, real quick, when we talk about transitioning, what in a nutshell is that? And then I want to talk about what our response is, you know, as a church and as Christians to those that are struggling with this. And you know, the question of sin and grace. But what is transitioning, real quick?
Okay, well, there are different levels and different degrees of intensity of gender dysphoria. Some people, not everyone who experiences gender dysphoria wants to go the whole way of having the surgery to become what they call sex reassignment surgery. Usually when people talk about transitioning, they're talking about that process of, because it's not just one surgery, it's multiple surgeries, and there's hormone treatments that have to take, and psychological treatments that have to take place beforehand. And, you know, so there's stages, if you will, if you want to become the other sex. And you can back out, and some people will say, you know what, I'm going to take the hormones and develop breasts, and my voice may change a little, and my body hair patterns may change because I'm taking the hormones of the other sex, but I'm not going to have the surgery. Sure. And or some people will find that the gender dysphoria is alleviated simply by cross-dressing. If they cross-dress, they may feel that the gender dysphoria is alleviated. What I wouldn't do, and I'm only learning, we're all just learning, the scientists do not know what causes this, and we're all trying to figure out how best to treat it. I don't believe that a person who experiences gender dysphoria, that experience of pain that they have is itself a sin, any more than I would say an anorexic, you know, who has this feeling of being overweight, that is a sin. It is a result of the fall. But where I do think we can cross the line is when you start to transition. if you start to train, if a person, especially if a person goes the whole way and has the sex reassignment surgery where the genitals are reconstructed, you know, breast implants or mastectomy is done, you know, that's, I think that's a point where we have to say as confessional Lutherans, you have now rejected God's creation. Now, I, it almost pains me to say that in a way, because I know that the people who are going through this would much prefer any other way. They just simply can't think of a way. And all psychotherapy that we have and the pharmaceuticals that we possess don't really alleviate gender dysphoria. The thing is, and people have to know this, and I know we're running out of time, but
just got a couple minutes here.
Is that a lot of patients who have the sex reassignment surgery, you know, there are statistics, I can give you an article that you could link to. It doesn't necessarily make their life better. That, you know, the gender dysphoria may be alleviated, but there's often a lot of other mental issues that go along with it that are just as bad. So the suicide rate of post-operative transsexuals is much higher than the average, and there's a reason for that. And we just don't always, we don't understand all those reasons.
Well, there is certainly a lot to chew on here, and you've given us a lot of great information. I know that the big struggle is, you know, the thing that would concern me as a former campus pastor is when someone seeks to stop struggling.
Yeah.
You know, the first commandment, we should fear, love, and trust in God above all things. And the first article of the creed, that I believe that God has made me and all creatures, that he's given me my body and soul, my eyes, ears, and all my members, and he still takes care of them. At some point, do we not have to do our best to try to work with someone who's struggling in this way to repent of their sin? And even though having the struggle maybe isn't in itself inherently sinful, but trying to bring them back to a state where they're not turning their back on the spiritual remedies that God has given through his word and sacraments.
Absolutely. And we may never, it does appear, this is very treatment resistant. A person who has this, and I wish this weren't true, but they may just simply have this thorn in the flesh or this suffering their entire life. And we can hope that they can learn to cope with it, manage it. You know, there is no cure. There is no easy cure.
And there is no necessarily physical, you know, we want there to be a physical remedy to a mental
right.
illness, and
right.
there may not be.
Right. Right. We don't usually treat mental illness with surgical solutions, and there's a reason for that. And if in fact science, and we have to be a little open to this possibility, if in fact medical science says, you know what, we found a region of the brain that develops differently, and we you know, well, maybe there would then be a surgical, but it would be a surgery on the brain. You know, the problem lies in the brain, not in the genitalia or the sex characteristics.
Real quick, we just got about 30 seconds here, but any advice to students or campus ministry workers that come across people or that are struggling with this?
Yeah, my first thought is don't freak out. You know, just don't freak out. You know, if someone says something that they're experiencing this, you gotta love them, be compassionate, show them mercy. I'm not saying compromise your faith. But show them mercy and just, you know, don't react with horror and then and avoid them, because if they feel isolated, then it's not going to help at all.
Well, hey, Pastor Stiegemeier, this was great to have you today. On a personal note, you're going to make an awesome professor there at Concordia University, Irvine, and it does my heart good to know that we've got wonderful ordained pastors out there talking about things like this and bioethics, and God's blessings to you on the beginning of your school year.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Well, that should about do it here on the campus of LCMSU. We'll see you next week. In the meantime, learn more about LCMSU at lcmsu.org. And while you're at it, you can download all the archives of the Student Union at KFUOAM.org. Remember, wherever you go to school, we look forward to having you join us here in the Student Union on the campus of LCMSU. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help.